This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about feminism in the 21st century, and with me to discuss this issue is Myra Marks Ferry, who co-edited a new book called Global Feminism, Transnational Women's Activism, Organizing, and Human Rights. Myra Ferry, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much.
Why'd you decide to tackle such a big subject?
Well, Eileen Murray Tripp, my co-editor and I, we're both involved in international studies. She's an Africanist. I'm more of a Europeanist. And thinking about the kinds of seminars and things that we were offering graduate students and the people that we were inviting and having talked to graduate students, we thought, wait a minute, we're bringing an awful lot of very high-powered people to Madison who are saying really fantastic things and getting our students involved in looking at these broad pictures. And it's not going beyond Madison. This is kind of foolish. If we've got all this good work and all these great ideas floating around, we should pull them together and get them a wider distribution. So that's what we did. And we really worked to make sure that the people who are more activist types were involved in the volume, that students were involved in the volume, that it wasn't just the academics talking about the theory of feminism as a global phenomenon, but both empirical studies and activist perspectives.
Well, to what extent is feminism a global phenomenon?
Oh, it's primarily at this point, I would say, a global phenomenon. In many ways, the U.S., which in the 1968 to, say, 1978 decade, was really the leader of global feminism, was an exporter of feminist ideas, was an exporter of feminist models of doing feminist politics, has lost that kind of preeminent role. Most of what's happening that's exciting in feminism today is happening in places other than the U.S.
Now, did the U.S. lose that because it was perceived by the recipients as a Western U.S. or white middle class or upper class gift, or are there other reasons for that?
Oh, other reasons. I think it's that the U.S. got certain kinds of things or got involved in certain kinds of things which resonated with things that were already going on in other parts of the world. And we lost our position less by being rejected than by stopping being engaged. We kind of drifted away. We got involved in necessary domestic struggles over the conservative agenda that was taking over the U.S. We've moved in a direction in the U.S. that is mostly defensive and, I won't say domestic, for the ways that people, many feminist organizations and many feminist scholars are looking abroad, but the energy of a grassroots movement is mostly domestic. We're not looking at ourselves as one country among many that's dealing with feminist issues, and pretty much every other feminist movement, every other country is.
And some of the issues here that have been paramount, especially abortion rights, is that issue as paramount in other countries?
Some countries, yes. Some countries, no. In many countries, abortion rights as a health issue have been pretty well established and are non-controversial, despite the presence of the Catholic Church as an opponent, despite mobilization from so-called pro-life movements. In other parts of the world, it's a key struggle. In Ireland, in Brazil, in Chile, it's a very big issue, but it's by no means a universal issue.
What do you think feminists and their allies here in the United States can do to make them more relevant to the struggles of global feminism?
Oh, quite a lot of things. First of all, I think pay attention to what those struggles are and listen to what people in other parts of the world are saying. so that when we go jumping in to engage in global issues, we don't do it in the way that we think that we are feminist leaders and we can export great feminist ideas to other parts of the country. Let's recognize that that is no longer true and that we can help with the indigenous feminist movements of other countries by sometimes best by lobbying our own government to get out of their way, and realizing that our government's often an obstacle and an ally with the governments that are least supportive of feminist goals. We line up with Vatican City. We line up with Saudi Arabia. We line up sometimes with Somalia. We're not exactly a progressive force in the world as a country.
The book also notes, Myra Ferry, that here in the United States, sometimes we don't realize the effect of U.S. policies through the IMF and the World Bank, how those affect women in and children in third world countries by savaging, actually, the public sector and any funding or a lot of funding for social and health issues.
Yeah, we don't pay attention to that, and we don't connect that issue to the ways in which domestically the same kind of neoliberal politics is happening in our country. So we tend to say, well, those are global issues and these are domestic issues, rather than seeing them all as part of a piece and one where we're struggling in a very difficult position, where some other feminists in some other parts of the world actually have more support from their governments, have more government commitments to change, have a more linked network to bring change and to participate in policymaking.
So like Bill Clinton's attack on so-called welfare as we know it and the continuing attacks by George W. Bush, including in his recent budget on social programs, including health, Head Start, and all sorts of things, are of a piece with policies that the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have imposed.
Absolutely. Well, and as we're going to see through the kinds of economic effects of the disastrous budget situations that have been created since Clinton, we're going to be facing some of the same kinds of draconian cutbacks with the same kinds of consequences for women and children that feminists in other parts of the world have already mobilized against. And if we would, for example, turn around and say, well, let's see if we can learn from feminists in Chile or feminists in South Africa or feminists in Taiwan how to organize against some of these things instead of assuming that we already have the answers, we already know, let's learn some strategies.
Well, what might some of those strategies be?
Well, for example, one of the things that has really been a global phenomenon has been trying to translate the Beijing Platform for Action into enforceable government policies. And it's been a bumpy road, and it's a very uneven set of progress, but there clearly is a sense that many feminists in many parts of the world are pushing to hold their governments accountable for achieving the Beijing Platform for Action goals along with the Millennium Development Goals, and that those two things together provide a kind of agenda for feminist activism.
Briefly,
and our country doesn't even look at it. The Beijing Platform for Action, what does that actually mean for action in the United States? We don't consider it as something that applies to us. We consider ourselves sort of exempt from that.
Myra Ferry is the co-editor of Global Feminism, Transnational Women's Activism, Organizing, and Human Rights. What are some of the goals of that Beijing conference?
Well, for example, gender mainstreaming is one goal, a controversial one, but one that's been very much picked up and pushed in a variety of parts of the world.
What does that mean?
It means taking gender seriously as a force in society, like class, like race or ethnicity, and recognizing that policy has to be accountable to both women and men, and that therefore every policymaking body in government and every budget should be specifying what the effects are for women and men of that kind of policy. So if you have a transportation policy, for example, that's very car-oriented, then gender mainstreaming would say, well, and what proportion of men drive solo in cars? What proportion of women? What proportion of women are dependent on public transportation as opposed to what proportion of men? How are children and mothers dependent on public transportation in ways that men are not? Or vice versa, that women and children are not able to access public transportation in ways that men are. But you ask the question about every policy from agriculture to transportation, not just, say, welfare policy or redistributive policy, but planning policy.
Now, some countries are doing this better than others.
Some countries are doing this very energetically, and other countries are kind of doing more in terms of rhetoric than realization of this. But there's a real push in that direction. Mm-hmm. Another aspect that's very seriously part of the Beijing Platform for Action, as well as the Millennium Development Goals, is advancing women's education. And yet in this country, what we're seeing is a backlash against women's education where a lot of conservative commentators are saying, well, women are getting more college degrees than men, so we have a problem here. We've got to change the school system so that men have their rightful advantage over women. You know, we're kind of out of step with the rest of the world.
I was interested. There's a fact in this book, Global Feminism, that I didn't know. There are a lot of facts in there I didn't know. But the one that relates to what we're talking about right now, Myra Ferry, is that the education gap has shrunk by about 50% all across the world. And that's a big success story.
It's a huge success story. And it's not a success story that just comes out of the blue. It comes as a consequence of serious international organizing, particularly among feminists who are concerned about development. And those concerns about development reach from feminist organizations in India and in China and in Europe and Latin America, but really have not had resonance beyond a small group of development-oriented professionals in the U.S. A grassroots women's movement in the U.S. has not really gotten serious about those kinds of concerns. And that's one of the things we're trying to spur with this book, is to get people to realize how much is going on that they could be part of.
Now, the term feminism itself, how embraced is that?
Quite variable, partly because people are not quite sure what the word feminism would mean in different contexts, because it means different things in different contexts. Just to take one example that I know well because I've studied Germany a lot, that's been one of my areas of concern. East German feminists, when German unification rolled along, were very concerned about what they saw as feminism as West German feminists practiced it and claimed that word, because their use of it involve things that we wouldn't even necessarily recognize. Their emphasis was really on supporting mothers outside the workforce to be caregivers, to encourage women into the workforce, but really to put much more emphasis on women as caregivers rather than and to emphasize parity for the kinds of jobs that women have conventionally done, you know, better pay for nurses, better pay for secretaries, better pay for elementary school teachers, and better working conditions, but with a kind of taking for granted the gender division of labor. And for East German feminists who had been pushed much more into conventionally male jobs, their concerns were more about how was the labor market going to be shifted? They didn't want to give up jobs in order to do caregiving. They wanted to know how men were going to be pushed into doing caregiving. They wanted to know how men would be doing kindergarten teacher jobs and get involved in nursing and really break down the gender division of labor so it wasn't just women moving into men's jobs, but men moving into more doing more domestic work at home, doing more of the traditional women's jobs. And West German feminists didn't even understand this. They sort of said, but wait a minute, that would be taking jobs away from women if you move men into those jobs. And so you got a kind of misunderstanding back and forth. What was feminism? And there's also, in all of Eastern Europe, a real resistance to any kind of ism. They don't want to hear about socialism. They don't want to hear about communism. They don't want to hear about pacifism. They don't want to hear about feminism. They don't want an ism. They've had enough ideology.
That's a Soviet hangover, then.
It is definitely a Soviet hangover. And they would rather say, let's talk about particular pragmatic reform goals that will make our lives better and save your ideology for your little academic discussions. Mm.
There's a chapter or discussion in this book, Global Feminism, Myra Ferry, about the EU and it being kind of a way to seclude feminists in Europe it has had the effect of secluding feminists in Europe from what's going on elsewhere. Why would that be?
Well, that's not how I would exactly interpret that particular chapter. That's a chapter that I did with a graduate student of mine, Tanya Pedrovska. And what we were looking at is kind of the identities that different transnational feminist websites put out for, you know, what their concerns were. And what I would say is that we went into it kind of naively thinking about transnationalism as always global. And what we discovered in analyzing these websites was that transnationalism is often regional and that a lot of the energy of transnational feminist organizations in Europe goes into building and negotiating around the transnational entity called the European Union and trying to do gender mainstreaming there and trying to develop gender policy there. And that kind of regional integration becomes a priority. I think we would see the same thing if we took Spanish language websites in Latin America. They're very strongly regional. And another one of our chapters, the one by Melinda Adams, who was also a graduate student here when she wrote that piece, is about the development of the African Union and the ways in which the regional push to doing policies in your region transnationally. That's another, I think, important piece of it. And I think we were naive, and we're trying to sort of show how we were naive in assuming that transnationalism always meant global.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the vibrancy of African feminism?
A little bit. It's not really my expertise. It's really more something that Aile Mari Tripp, my co-editor, is very much engaged in. I've really learned a lot from her and working on this project with her about what's going on. And there are two things that are really impressive about what's happening in Africa. One is that women are very much engaged in the peace processes, the anti-war processes in Africa, trying to resolve conflicts, trying to de-escalate ethnic conflicts. There again, to go to your point about is feminism a dirty word, they're concerned about visions of feminism that come from the West that talk a lot about we have to appreciate difference, because their commitment is to the idea that difference is what leads to ethnic conflict, that difference is what leads to people killing each other. We have to emphasize the fact that we are not different. We are really all human beings. We are women together. We have an interest in not playing with difference. And so they've been very much in the lead in conflict resolution. And interestingly, in those countries in Africa that have come to resolve conflicts and are moving back towards some kind of democratic state and electoral representation, women are more represented in those parliaments, in those governments, in those leadership positions than they are in other countries, not only in Africa, but in the rest of the world. And so she's actually going on to another research project that's actually looking at peacemaking and politics comparatively in three different African countries. But it's clear that that's a trend across Africa.
You know, it's interesting you bring up this question of feminism and peacemaking, because I've been reading way back at the turn of the 20th century, actually, 1909 to 1925, volumes of the Progressive magazine, because we're approaching our 100th anniversary, and Belcase La Follette was a big suffragist. Mm-hmm. She was the wife of Robert La Follette, who founded the Progressive, and she goes to a Women's International League for Peace and Freedom meetings with Jane Addams.
Absolutely.
And they integrate this suffragist movement with anti-war.
Absolutely.
Pacifist movement. And that is continuing now.
Absolutely.
And so that strikes me as resonating with a point that you were making, I believe, in your introduction, Myra Ferry, where you say that feminism is not confined to issues of women's status, power.
Right.
Equality.
That's something that, again, all of the authors in the chapters were very emphatic about, and where I would say it was really, not that we didn't think that way, but it was an education for us to see the various perspectives on how that is true. And it's not only about, for example, the facile way in which often in the U.S. that is connected to, well, of course, it's not just about gender, it's about gender, race, and class, and we have to talk about economic inequalities of all types. True. But it's broader than that. It is also about pacifism and about issues about war and the destruction that war does to everybody, but particularly to women and children, and the ways in which women, in recognizing that and struggling to defend themselves and their families and their friends and their communities, are claiming power as women and for women to make that an agenda issue. It's also about things like education and literacy, not just because it's women who are more often illiterate, women who are less educated, but also because women can see the ways in which education and literacy are important for them, for their families, for their communities. They're kind of connected into those networks, and so for them, that's a really high priority. The human rights issues as well. It's not just about women's rights as human rights and saying violence against women is a human rights issue, but recognizing the way in which as women become engaged in fighting for their human rights, they also become engaged in a broader struggle for human rights across the board, for human rights. And we see that kind of phenomenon happening in many parts of the globe. And seeing that from the perspective of the different regions of the world and the different transnational organizations, for us, just underlined how strongly that was true.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest this week, Myra Ferry, co-editor of a new book called Global Feminism, Transnational Women's Activism, Organizing, and Human Rights. There is a shadow over the book, and that is 9/11 and the rise of fundamentalism. To what extent is that a threat to the gains that feminism have made over the last 30 years?
Well, this is not something we deal with this a little bit in the book, in that we have a wonderful chapter by Yakin Ertürk, who is Turkish, a sociologist who teaches at Middle Eastern University in Ankara, and who has also served as the director of education in Saudi Arabia and has also been the director of the Division on the Advancement of Women in the UN. So she has a global perspective as well as a local perspective within both Turkey and Saudi Arabia on the varieties of Islam and the global reactions to Islam. And she's quite eloquent, I think, in her chapter in talking about the ways in which feminists and Islamic feminists or, I'm not as eloquent as she is about this kind of issue, but the ways in which those feminists who are struggling to assert women's rights within a national context have also to connect with and think about what their connections are with these global movements, and that they're doing so. And so you see, for example, organizations like Women Living Under Muslim Law, which is a fascinating organization because it both represents national chapters for countries like Turkey and Indonesia and Saudi Arabia, where Muslim law, Sharia, is part of the national structure, but it also represents Muslim women who feel themselves living under Muslim law, living voluntarily under the dictates of Islam in France, Germany, the UK, the US. So you have this interesting mix of individual and national groups trying to work out what the future of Islamic feminism will be, which is not a contradiction in terms, as Yakin Ertürk makes very clear, and trying to work against the fundamentalization of Islam. And I think those of us who are more Christian feminists can look at that and say, wait a minute, we're doing the same thing here. We're seeing Christianity being fundamentalized and being used to push a particular kind of right-wing and nationalist agenda, and we don't like the way in which the label of Christian is being used to describe a particular kind of aggressive, literalist, right-wing version of Christianity. We think there's a different version of Christianity. And I guess I would say, if Christian feminists were as outspoken and as organized and as active as Yakin talks about Islamic feminists being in struggling against that fundamentalism within their own country, we'd see a different kind of domestic politics going on here.
What is the temperature of right-wing fundamentalism here in the United States, do you think?
Well,
is it going up or is it going down?
It depends on whether you're saying the temperature of the whole country as affected by it, which I think is going down, or the sense within those communities that they are beleaguered and unsupported and therefore need to be the more radical and more nationalist because of that, which, of course, is the same kind of dynamic that we do see
but
in Islamic countries.
Do you think the power is diminishing here in the U.S.? Or
I'm hoping so. I think the last election was a point in that direction. I think we can see other kinds of things, including, for example, as I say, Christian feminists beginning to reclaim the name and not being unwilling to stand up in public and say, oh, yes, I'm a feminist and I'm a Christian and I'm a leftist. And Christian doesn't seem to be a contradiction to that. And I think we need to have more of that vocal argument in order to reclaim that, because, of course, a very, very large proportion of this country identifies itself as Christian, and if one allows the title Christian to only mean that fundamentalist version of Christianity, we're in trouble just as much as Turkey is if Islam only means the particular fundamentalist version of Islam that some people are propagating.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Myra Ferry, on this. We need to be careful with our terminology, that there's left-wing fundamentalism, there's right-wing fundamentalism, there's left-wing Catholicism, there are left-wingers in the Mormon church.
Absolutely.
There's left-wingers in the evangelical churches. So there's left-wingers in Judaism, and there are right-wingers in Judaism. And so we need to be much more precise. We've got about a minute left. What big challenge or do you see confronting global feminism in the next couple of years?
I think one of the big challenges is to get the United States back into a position more aligned with more progressive forces, getting more feminist energy focused globally, but also focused on pushing the country in a direction in which it could engage constructively in a global discussion. Defusing some of the masculinist rhetoric, the bellicosity, the general go-it-alone cowboy mentality, which is a very anti-feminist mentality.
So in a way, we need to de-Bushify the United States right now, and that's a big project. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Myra Ferry, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Progressive Radio. The book again, Global Feminism, Transnational Women's Activism, Organizing, and Human Rights.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.